is the New South Wales Country Hour with Michael Condon on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Hello again and welcome to the show. Coming up, supermarket giant Woolworths, it's cutting its own label of milk that was saying that farmers should be getting paid a bit more. We'll hear more about that shortly. Also, New South Wales beekeepers say varroa mite infestations are worsening across the state with the new chemically resistant variety, and there are fears for the future of food growers that are reliant on pollination.
Especially because we had the second incursion of varroa mite earlier on, which has just been a disaster due to it being resistant to synthetic treatments. It's a completely different genetic pool and it's really challenging to manage and costly for sure.
You might want to comment on any of the stories that you hear on the program. 0467 922 684. We'll also look at bird flu as well, the latest there, and the situation in regards to those pelican deaths. It's been confirmed it was not bird flu. We'll hear more about that shortly as well. But first up today, supermarket giant Woolworths is cutting its own label of milk that assured consumers that farmers were being paid well. Woolworths says it's ending its farmers' own milk brand and not renewing contracts with its own dairy farmer suppliers. The brand has already been removed from shelves in South Australia and will leave the supermarkets in WA, Queensland, New South Wales and Victoria by 2027. Tim Bale is a dairy farmer from northern New South Wales and was instrumental in the creation of the farmer's own brand and his direct relationship with farmers. He's now looking for someone else to take his milk.
So farmers' own milk that we've been supplying now for about 12 years is going to finish, and it has already finished in some states as a brand. But Woolworths are assuring us that they're going to honour the end of the contract and look after us for a while, but we do need to find another home.
So, yeah, they've told you your existing contract stands, but at the end of it, this brand will cease to exist and they no longer need your supply.
Yes, and as a matter of fact, the brand may cease before that, and depending on what deals they can do with other processors. So, for example, in Queensland, it's already off the shelf, but the farmers are still being paid by Woolworths, but the milk is going to Bega.
And what's the history of this brand? Because it was really pitched as a way people could be assured farmers like you were being paid a good amount for their milk, wasn't it?
Well, true, and yes, it has worked that way. You know, we were pretty happy to do that. Unfortunately, when you're dealing with such a big company like that, we got lost in the shelf space, I think, is for want of a better word. And it became hard for them in what to do, and the oversupply to pick up suppliers is a lot different from actually just having milk delivered to your shop. But, you know, we had so many different buyers over the years that the story gets lost. You know, it's a bit like the old saying where the first farmer makes it, the second farmer holds it, and the third one loses it. So they lose that passion that the first group of buyers had in the first place.
Yeah, and you were heavily involved in getting this all up and running, weren't you? So are you sad to see it go?
Yeah, I am, but we have had a good run. What worries me more is the overall effect and the timing. A couple of farmers now that can't be picked up at all. The farmer's own milk is going to be, you know, lumped in with other milk. It's going to affect what some processors can pay and pick up. It's going to be hard for us to hold a price, and it's going to be hard for all farmers to hold a price.
Yeah, so with this notice that when the contract ends, you need to find a new home for your milk, I'd imagine for suppliers down where I am in areas like Victoria where there are a lot of different milk companies, that might be easy for those farmers. But farmers like yourself up in northern New South Wales and in other areas of the country, is it going to be hard to find someone else for your milk?
Yes, at the moment, nobody wants any more milk. That's one of the big issues. North of Sydney, they don't want any more milk. You Victorian farmers down there are sending too much milk up. So we could very easily fix the problem, and I'm sure the Victorians would agree with me, pay more money. So, you know, it works out that processors look at the Victorian price plus freight, and while the Victorian price is not up there where it should be, it affects the whole country.
Tim Bale is a dairy farmer from Stuarts River in New South Wales, and he was talking about farmers' own milk from Woolworths. It's finishing up in 2027 in New South Wales. He was speaking about that with Warwick Long. You might have some thoughts on that. You can send us a text 0467 922 684.
Every community has stories worth sharing. ABC Your Say is your chance to join the conversation. Tell us what's on your mind. Visit abc.net.au/yoursay.
Over in Southwest Riverina, just outside the small village of Nerricon, there's an increasing amount of reports of kangaroos drowning in a canal there. The Murrumbidgee Irrigation Canals are lined with black plastic and are tightly fenced, making it difficult for the roos to get out once they're inside. There are currently no state regulations relating to egress points and animal welfare in canals. Dr. Kylie Sons is a research fellow at the University of Melbourne who specialises in urban ecology. She talks to Nicola Sicardo about the dangers of these types of canals.
I think it's very fair to say that the plastic exacerbates the danger of these canals. I can absolutely understand why the plastic has been implemented. It's a common tension with any of these kinds of infrastructure is they have a purpose. They have a main job to do, and that is to get water from A to B and to lose as little of it as possible along the way. But we don't have to do that in a way that also costs so many wildlife lives. Canals and channels can actually be a really big source of mortality for animals as they fall in and they drown and they can't escape. And when they're quite wide, they can also create barriers to movement for animals through the landscape. And this is a problem that's been seen all around the world.
And looking at it from that perspective, what are you seeing, you know, from other areas of the world? Like, are they seeing the same issue? Do they have better solutions to the problem?
It's definitely a really widespread problem. So, you know, there are some studies that have found in Spain something like over a five-year period, more than 500 mammals drowned in quite a short stretch of irrigation canal. And these include things like deer and fox and badgers. When we go to South America and the Amazon, we're having, you know, anteaters and all these forest animals. And they're just the big animals that we can see quite easily. We also know that small animals like amphibians can be affected by these canals because, you know, they're water animals and that's great for them, but they can't live in there indefinitely. They need to be able to get out. And so we have all kinds of animals that are drowning in these canals.
What are the solutions here? Are there any, like, are there any countries that are doing well in trying to, you know, conquer this situation?
Yeah, I mean, the Netherlands has some really great work. They are a country of canals. It's one of the things that they're famous for. And so they might redesign the canals to provide escape ramps, either by adding them as structures to the edge, and these can be quite simple things made out of wood or sticks, just to add something for an animal that can't grab onto a slippery or hard surface to grip onto, some kind of natural textured material. They often cut escape ramps into the edge of the canal and line them with rocks and create a bit more of a slope so that animals that do fall in, as they're swimming along the bank, they can eventually find an escape ramp and get themselves out. Another thing that has been done and is often proposed is covering canals so that they're no longer open air. And obviously that would be an excellent solution. It would, you know, reduce the amount of water lost to evaporation. It would provide movement pathways for animals across the road and reduce drowning. But that is a huge undertaking for, you know, thousands of kilometres of canals.
What would be the more easier solutions that could be implemented at a canal like this one?
Yeah, retrofitting some kind of escape ramps, I think, would be a really important solution here. A lot of these animals will be able to get themselves out of the water. They just need something to grab onto. So, you know, whether it's wooden ladders that are put in along the banks intermittently, any kind of wooden or textured ramps can be really important.
When you're looking at, you know, the videos and the photos of this canal, what's the fencing situation? Like, I know at the moment we're seeing kangaroos that just hopping over it and then they're unable to get out. Could you touch a little bit about fencing and what needs to be done to kind of, I guess, accommodate for animals, you know, that might slip through or jump over?
Yeah, look, fencing is a surprisingly complicated issue when it comes to fencing for wildlife, especially Australian wildlife. There are so many different ways that they can move. There's not even really a one-size-fits-all fence, because something that you might design to fence a koala is very different for something that you might design to fence a kangaroo, and different again to keeping out lizards and turtles and frogs. And so at the moment, it looks like the kangaroos are able to jump over this fence, which is part of the problem, because it seems like because there's so much land on one side of the fence, they can get a good run-up, which allows them to propel themselves over the fence and into the canal area. But once they're in the canal area, there's not a lot of wiggle room. So even if they manage to avoid falling into the canal, getting enough speed and propulsion to get themselves out of that corridor is really difficult. Fencing is really important. It either needs to be high enough to completely exclude kangaroos from the canal area, or there need to be escape ramps that allow any animals that have accidentally found themselves in the channel corridor to get themselves out.
Dr. Kylie Soans is a research fellow at the University of Melbourne. In a statement, Murrumbidgee Irrigation says it's committed to ongoing improvement and was continuing to assess infrastructure to identify further ways to enhance animal safety. 17 minutes past 12 here on the New South Wales Country Hour. Well, to other forms of animal mortality now. The federal government will start rolling out vaccinations against bird flu for priority species in the coming days. In Canberra, ministers and experts said the states will decide which species are prioritised, but zoos will likely be the place a vaccination program starts. Agriculture Minister Julie Collins, Environment Minister Murray Watt and Chief Vet Dr. Beth Cookson spoke about it to the media this week.
We have been very clear that this will continue to spread across the country. We also know that as the disease becomes more widespread in wildlife, counting individual confirmed birds no longer gives us the clearest picture of how this disease is spreading. So our reporting will evolve to focus on confirmed H5 events and the developments that matter most. I'll now hand to Minister Watt.
Today's announcement is another step in supporting our bird population to face up to the massive challenge of bird flu. As the Environment Minister, I very much welcome this development and this announcement by Minister Collins to roll out targeted vaccinations of priority native species. As we've heard, Australia has been doing vaccination trials for some period of time, and now we're making a commitment to roll out those vaccinations more broadly, with the federal government supporting states and territories to vaccinate priority species that they identify based on expert advice. It is difficult to vaccinate birds in the wild. It does take two vaccination doses to vaccinate birds, and it is difficult enough to catch wild birds once, let alone twice. Where it's possible to vaccinate wild birds, we will do so. But the priority here is to vaccinate birds that are in captivity. And of course, in our zoos and various other institutions, we've been taking steps to ensure that we do have populations of our most vulnerable bird species. And they're going to be the priority when it comes to vaccinations.
Environment Minister Murray Watt. Well, Damien Cook is Director and Senior Restoration Ecologist at the Wetland Revival Trust and was kayaking at Lake Corndilla in Kinchega National Park when he found a mass bird death last Friday. Authorities say laboratory testing of the samples of the birds found no evidence of H5 bird flu, with all samples testing negative. Damien explains what he found and how shocking it was to find 400 dead pelican chicks and juveniles.
There was lots of very young pelicans that had just fledged, and they were all swimming around feeding, and there was big flocks of terns, the inland sort of freshwater terns we have, so Caspian terns and gullbill terns, which are actually where I'm from, we might see a handful of gold-billed terns at a wetland, but there was hundreds, literally hundreds of the gold-billed terns, and so that was pretty exciting. And then I realised, yeah, some of the pelicans were quite young, quite recently fledged, and I realised there was an island had been exposed. As the level of the lake drops down, an island becomes exposed, and just opposite the Corndilla campground. And so I paddled across to there, and from a distance I thought, oh, that doesn't look good. This looks like there's dead birds on the island. So I paddled closer, and it soon became evident there was piles of dead pelicans on the island. So, and I've been aware of the bird flu, obviously. I had some training. I work with Indigenous ranger groups in northern Victoria, and we'd had some training about identifying and what to do, or how to respond to finding dead birds. Because pelicans sometimes, there can be natural mortality around breeding colonies, particularly so a place like Lake Eyre, where the birds will breed and then the food resources drop down, particularly if the lake starts to dry out, and the parents can't finish feeding the chicks, and so the chicks can't fledge and fly away. So and so you do get these mass mortality sometimes. There was basically piles of young pelicans. Looked like they'd been standing around in little creches and all of a sudden just collapsed on each other, like they'd died quite quickly.
Damien Cook explaining how he found those 400 dead pelican chicks and juveniles. Chris Purnell is a manager of wetland and migratory shorebirds at BirdLife Australia, and recorded the mass kill that Damien found there to the state government. He said it was a relief that the birds tested negative to H5 bird flu, and the amount of pelicans descending on Menindee could play a factor. But he says, ultimately, when you see that many bird deaths, nothing can be ruled out.
Very concerned given the sort of current pandemic, zoonotic, which is getting around. And there is, you know, because of the high densities of birds in these areas, there's always the threat of disease and botulism. But we do know that pelicans behave like this in colonial scenarios. So it was a sense of relief. But then that was quickly nipped in the bud when we got news of the greater crested tern, which got a positive result from Wentworth, not too far away.
When you look at this particular incident that occurred with these 400 dead pelicans, chicks and juveniles there, H5 has been ruled out. And speaking to Dr. Rhys Power only a day or so ago, he alerted that there's now more testing that can be done to try and actually find a cause, but given the extent of the carcasses, it might be a presumed cause rather than an actually known one, depending on how testing goes. What other major causes could there be? Is it simply, when you say lack of resources, is it simply just not much food around, or is it the water quality that may have subsided over recent months?
Normally a lack of resources, so it may not be a complete depletion of resources, but understanding what the scenario is up there, Damien said that there's multiple breeding populations still going, and that there's fishing birds like cormorants off the nest and actively fishing. So perhaps it was a case of the pelicans anticipating the amount of birds that had descended upon this one location would deplete the resources before they could get the chicks through to independence. And we saw that again, as I said, up in 2022 at Carrawinya, just across the border in Queensland, when around 6,000 chicks were abandoned in a pelican colony. It's not unusual, but in this case, it's we're almost hoping that that's the situation. And fingers crossed that we don't get any reports of further disease. So hopefully botulism and H5 can be ruled out with further testing.
That's Chris Purnell, the manager of wetland and migratory shorebirds at BirdLife Australia, talking about the finding of the 400 dead pelican chicks and juveniles at Lake Corndilla. It's coming up to 25 minutes past 12 here on the New South Wales Country Hour. Well, still talking about biosecurity now, and with all the attention on bird flu, beekeepers say they're being overlooked. New South Wales beekeepers say varroa mite infestations are worsening across the state, and there are fears for the future of food growers that are reliant on pollination. The new pesticide-resistant varroa mite is now drastically hitting bee numbers in commercial hives, but also in wild bee populations as well. The cost of treating hives for varroa mite has affected beekeepers and flowed onto other industries as the wild honeybee population declines due to this second wave of the pest. New South Wales Apiarist Association is calling on the New South Wales government to provide grants to help cover the mounting costs of treating these hives. Zach Alcock is president of New South Wales Apiarist Association. He says that since bird flu was detected, a lot of the biosecurity attention has shifted away from bees and varroa mite.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially because we had the second incursion of varroa mite earlier on, which has just been a disaster due to it being resistant to synthetic treatments. It's a completely different genetic pool, and it's really challenging to manage and costly. So, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So are you seeing a big reduction in bees because of that?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of operators selling up. A recent survey showed that many beekeepers are planning to leave the industry and more have a lot of low confidence. We've just got to accept varroa is there and we have to manage it. And yeah, we're keeping bees healthy still, but it's just hurting our hip pocket, and really beekeepers just can't keep carrying the burden of food security at our expense without any assistance.
So you're saying that there aren't enough bees to pollinate, and you need a bit of help to sort of get them healthy to do that?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, there is ways to manage varroa, especially synthetic resistant. There is organic options. It's just costing a lot. And, yeah, we beekeepers just can't keep going without any assistance and recognition from the government.
So where are the costs coming from mainly now in terms of this latest incursion?
Yep, so it's a lot of labour costs. Like, organic treatments are a lot more labour-intensive and time-consuming than synthetic treatments. And a lot of times, some of the times they don't even work, so we've got to repeatedly work hives. Everything else on top of that with cost of production, it's just a nightmare, really. It's a recipe for disaster.
So when you're talking about because the chemicals are no longer working on this latest version of varroa, is that right?
Yeah, correct, mate. Yeah, we're really just relying on organic chemicals to control the varroa, which is possible, but yeah, it is a lot more expense to the beekeeper.
So I suppose the croppers can't pay the extra or won't pay the extra. So you're hoping to get some government help?
Yeah, absolutely. We can't rely on the horticultural industry to just keep paying more. Obviously, we need to be rewarded for the work we're doing. But, yeah, look, with some recognition and some help from government would be great. Like, there was a industry-led national emergency roundtable held a few weeks ago to call on state governments to support our industry. And, yeah, frankly, the commitments made by state governments was pretty insufficient.
And so you're saying it's a food security issue, so we're going to see a lot of horticultural crops, almond crops, those sorts of things, maybe even cereal crops affected?
Yes, 100%, yeah. Canola, almonds, the list just goes on of dependent crops. And the thing is, the wild unmanaged honeybee populations have been wiped out by varroa. So a lot of growers were relying on these populations to pollinate crops, but yeah, this is seen as an unpriced service, and many growers are now having to stop and determine what services they might need from our industry to ensure the crop outputs are maintained.
And you're saying the farmers can't pay any extra?
Well, yeah, we can't just keep, you know, putting the price up, obviously, but it needs to be accordingly. But yeah, we can't just keep putting the price up, that's for sure.
Yeah, so I mean you can't do it if you're not making some money.
Exactly. No, that's exactly right. Beekeepers, you know, are really being asked to carry costs that benefit the agricultural sector and Australian food production. And we're not making much money out of it at all.
So you can't make extra money out of, with, say, the honey? They're just not the volume there?
Look, they're just the prices. They're okay, but cost of production, there's really not much margin at all.
And it's the chemical issue, really, that's hitting you now?
Yeah, Yeah, so and it's just the labour and the increased monitoring and treatments for the secondary mite that is, it's really hurting us, the labour and their monitoring and tarred with that.
And I guess, too, the other thing is if you're not using as much chemical, it's got to be healthier. So there's a positive there, but you're not getting paid for that, though.
No, that's right. It's not all doom and gloom. Like, we can, keep bees healthy, they're looking good and operators are learning to adapt. And there needs to be a bee industry there as, it's Australia's food security. And I feel like we're being, pretty much ignored by the government.
So what would you like the government to do? How much sort of help do you need? What sort of money?
Any assistance would be great. We've seen other states, get some help but to date, we've had no commitment.
They're paying a lot of money for bird flu, they're paying a lot of money for surveillance of other diseases. Now that it's here, varroa's here, you just need to help to help to get the bees healthier.
Yeah, absolutely we do. Yeah, just some assistance to get over this tough time. And, beekeepers and growers alike, we all need to work together and work out a solution because at the end of the day we need bees.
Otherwise we don't have crops.
That's correct, yes. And we're losing beekeepers rapidly because there's just not enough. Yeah, it's just not sustainable at the moment.
That's Zach Alcock, who's the president of the New South Wales Apiarists Association. We went to the New South Wales government for a comment. They said that the Minister for Agriculture, Tara Moriarty, in a statement says the Minns government has committed $67.9 million to varroa mite response and transition to management phase and has worked closely with the industries to roll out the support. They've also announced new funding of $9.5 million for a program announced in December 2025 for continued support, which includes the following: an enhanced honeybee compliance program, biosecurity extension, training for beekeepers and specialised research for the industry. The New South Wales government recognises the challenges facing commercial beekeepers and is investing in actions that benefit as many participants as possible. It says a recent request for a direct subsidy such as $50 per hive would cost approximately $15 million for a single year, and the government says it's unlikely to address the underlying challenges facing the sector to ensure the industry's future. They say they regularly meet with the Australian Honeybee Council, the federal government, Honeybee Industry Council, and they're saying that they're continuing to work with the bee industry, government agencies and other state governments to evaluate options to support the industry now and into the future. So that's a response from the government about the need for more help from New South Wales apiarists, saying that they're losing beekeepers and losing a number of bees, and the wild bee population is in decline because of varroa mite and that second pesticide-resistant varroa mite as well. It's 28 minutes to one here on the New South Wales Country Hour, and that's time to get some news headlines now from Adam Storey. Good afternoon.
Afternoon, Michael. The Prime Minister says he's had a productive phone call with US President Donald Trump. They discussed a number of issues, including AUKUS, which the Prime Minister says remains full steam ahead. Now, the Prime Minister says Mr. Trump also agreed to consider exempting Australian exports from the current 12.5% tariff that was imposed recently, but he also noted that the President has a different perspective on the matter of tariffs than Australia, so we'll see where that goes. There's been another incident at Sydney Airport. This one occurred last Sunday, and it's only emerged last night of what actually happened. It was a Virgin Australia plane that was forced to abort a takeoff after being cleared at the same time a Qantas plane was cleared to taxi on the same runway, and this follows two other incidents over the weekend, which is being blamed on a lack of air traffic controllers. So the ATSB says about 60 runway incidents happen every year across the country, but not often at the major airports, certainly not Sydney. Members of the Defence Force have joined their search for an experienced teenage bushwalker who's missing in the Natai National Park. 18-year-old Lily Hooper left home from Oakdale on Wednesday morning, telling her family she was planning on a hike. Police were alerted after she didn't return home that evening. with officers later discovering her car in the parking area at the start of a walking trail, and a multi-agency search is now in its third day. Roundtable discussions on bushfire preparations taking place today in Sydney. The Rural Fire Service Commissioner Trent Curtin says the rainfall in recent months has led to increased fuel loads for potential fires. And tributes today for the Australian musician and entertainer Johnny Young, who's died at the age of 79. Obviously best known for the presenter and producer of Young Talent Time back in the 70s and 80s, and also songwriter, singer and producer in his own right.
Yes, of course, that's right, indeed. And that Beatles hit as well, which he sang every week.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I think he
All
made
My
that,
Loving.
I think he made that song more famous than the Beatles ever did, actually. Yeah.
He had his own style, a sort of delicate style.
Oh, yeah,
that's right. So, 79.
Yep.
Yep, Johnny Young. All right, well, thanks for that. No doubt there'll be tributes for Johnny later on in the program and on ABC Radio this afternoon, no doubt.
For sure.
Thanks for that, Adam. And you'll be back at 1 o'clock.
I'll be back at 1.
Okay. Let's find out what's happening with the weather details, and Jordan Natara's at the Bureau. Good afternoon.
Yes, good afternoon, Michael.
So that hybrid is just in the main feature. All the rain sort of moved through now?
Yeah, so a lot of our rain in the next couple of days, particularly over the weekend, is going to be focused around our coastal parts. Heaviest falls we do see are around sort of 10 or so millimetres in the far northern parts of our coastal areas, but not expecting anything in spreading across the range themselves as the winds are starting to end more onshore. The secondary side of it is that we are starting to see, by the time we get towards early next week, a trough start to form in the far west of the state. So areas near Broken Hill where we're starting to see the combination of moisture being fed in from those easterly winds increasing with some warmer temperatures. We're going to see some pockets of showers and storms in those areas during afternoon hours of Monday, Tuesday and Wednesday. And as mentioned yesterday, well, there is a bit of an uncertainty trend exactly how things are going to progress. But looking by mid-next week, there could be a transition for that same trough moving further towards the east and potentially tracking across the southeastern coastline by the late part of next week.
So, yeah, not much rain in it, but a little bit here and there and moving across from the west. But it's not like only a few millimetres here and there.
Yeah, a lot of it is going to be quite light. The storm activity in and around there definitely has the potential could bring a little bit more. And at the moment, it's not necessarily high moisture through the atmosphere, but enough moisture at the surface level that's obviously building that instability. So the most likely outcome is going to be one of a couple of millimetres throughout day by day. But as we go to that longer term uncertainty and how that system moves towards the east, as those potential features start to hit towards the ranges themselves, there is the increased chance we could see a bit more rainfall as that moves through, but again, the uncertainty is quite high at this stage for that long forecast lead time.
Yeah, so that high likely to sit there for a number of days then. Really, you can't sort of see beyond that in terms of the forecast for the 7 days.
Yeah, so quite a slow-moving system at the moment with those coastal showers in the short term. Again, quite slow-moving trough through the inland over the next 5 or so days. Exactly how things move by late next week, again, a bit early to say, but there is that potential trend that we could see that feature that's in that far western part of the state shift towards the east, and that could, again, bring some more rain to areas around Dubbo Parks and down towards the ranges themselves. But again, too early to say exactly how much and exactly even the timing of this lead time.
Yeah, when is that? Is that like that's for like 6-7 days away?
Correct, yeah. Right. So Thursday, Friday next week, modelling suggesting that it could reach down towards those parts. The order of, again, higher end rainfall in that sort of 10 or so millimetres is possible, most likely driven by thunderstorm activity as we start to see in some of the models that system gets picked up by a cold front at that time. But again, timing of cold fronts 7 days out, we could be, again, 24 to 48 hours off for our forecast of this lead time. And it's a bit of a watch point for exactly how that's going to unfold and an area to watch for our forecast as we get across the next few days.
And if it's warmer, then it can disappear altogether.
Yeah, so at the moment, we're in quite a pattern that's obviously going to be one similar to what we'd be more attuned to, more summer-like. Again, the combination of that warm easterly, warm inland temperatures combined together bring the instability. Not necessarily rain-bandy-like system that we've been obviously seeing in past. More convective, more hit or miss. And at this stage, again, some higher totals in some parts, but not necessarily as widespread as maybe we've seen in some of the past events with those fronts.
Okay, Jordan, thanks for that.
Catch you later.
It's 21 minutes to one here on the New South Wales Country Hour. Well, this week it did produce some handy, if not torrential, falls of rain across particularly areas around Dubbo and other parts of the central west and northern central west of the state. But it wasn't enough. We're needed to give winter crops a boost. Well, the official rainfall figures for Coonamble this August is a total of 12 millimetres. For winter to date, it's just a bit over 60 millimetres. So what are the winter crops looking like at this stage, given the concern earlier in the season and over insufficient soil moisture profiles? Now, Coonamble only scored about 12 millimetres of rain this week, and there were some handy falls across the Western Plains, but it obviously didn't fall where it was most needed. To fill us in on the details, here's agronomist Tom Cullen.
145 to sort of 200 millimetres of rain we received in May, June, which sparked a few growers, particularly more east of the Castlereagh River. So overall, you would probably say it's about 25% of the districts in crop, 75% fallowed, and that's purely based on where better rain fell.
And what sort of falls did you hear about this week?
Yeah, anywhere from sort of 7 to 16 mil, 7 mil sort of further out west to sort of the foot of the Warren Bungles around that 16 mil. So we haven't had a decent rain event probably for 4 to 6 weeks. So that was very well timed. But yeah, we definitely need a bit more, that's for sure.
And what's the soil moisture profile looking like?
Well, where farmers, I suppose, have put crop in on sort of marginal moisture, you know, 30, 40 centimetres of soil moisture, that was basically run out. You know, some of these crops were just starting to really look yellow tipped. Early signs of moisture stress. That 8 mil will keep them going, but yeah, we're going to need a couple of inches. But yeah, where the better soil moisture is, we've probably got a bit of time. A lot of these crops just starting to come to that reproductive phase, you know, peak period for moisture and nutrition. And as the temperatures sort of start to rise, I guess that's going to really tell the story about how much moisture is in storage for these crops.
We've had a few frosts over the last few weeks, but it's been pretty light on for frosts this winter. Has that been a bit of a saving grace?
It has, yeah. Yeah, frost, you know, we have had our fair share of frosts, but yeah, nothing major. I think nothing but sort of below that minus one. So it definitely does dry a few things out, but yeah, we haven't had any issues there.
And predictions are still in place for a hotter, drier spring and summer. How do you think crops will fare going into that?
Yeah, I think a lot of the crops around here are sort of later planted. So there are some that will probably do it very tough and still have a lot of work to do, you know. Like usually we're sort of, all our crops are out in head or starting to flower. But there's some crops that are still a very long way off that. So I think the crops that were sort of put in a bit earlier, around that sort of early June, you know, they're going to fare okay as long as they've got that moisture underneath. But anyway, I think everybody knew what they were up against. The ones that took a punt will probably just have to say, well, we can cut it for hay, we can graze it. There's other options out there.
Do you think some of it will be grazed?
Yeah, for sure. Like, we're starting to have that conversation now with some farmers and things about probably further out west where the moisture's limiting, and you know, you got this all this biomass, and that's been a really good thing. Like a lot of our forage crops too, we've been able to have a quite a mild sort of May, June, July. So a lot of these forage crops usually planted late don't come to much, but there's a real body of feed out there, so can actually make something of these crops if it stops raining.
So it's certainly looking like harvest is going to be over pretty quickly this year.
Yeah, for sure. Like, I think to get a lot of these crops to that grain period, we're going to need, you know, some, I suppose some areas, you know, a good 30 to 50 mil and we'd see something at the end. But yeah, some of these other areas to the west, it's probably going to be more like a 50 to 100 mil to get them through.
That's Coonamble agronomist Tom Cullen speaking there with Kim Goldsmith. You're listening to The Country Hour. Well, let's turn our attention still to weather, rainfall and heat as well as we head into summer, because roundtable discussions on bushfire preparations are taking place today, aimed at coordinating resources between firefighters, New South Wales National Parks and regional communities. Rural Fire Service Commissioner Trent Curtin says the rainfall in recent months has led to increased fuel loads for potential fires. Commissioner Curtin says the roundtable is focusing on strengthening bushfire protections ahead of the summer months.
We know that over recent years, we've seen reduced windows for hazard reduction burning. We've seen increased rain. There's increased the amount of fuel across our landscapes. Despite that, this last year, we've been able to increase the amount of hazard reduction burning done across New South Wales. Land managers, together with fire agencies, have managed to achieve 124,000 hectares of land treated this year. Importantly, this has resulted in more than 174,000 properties being protected from risk from bushfire. We were able to do that because we initiated Task Force FireGuard. With better weather conditions, together with Task Force FireGuard, bringing together land managers and agencies to improve coordination, to reduce any barriers to getting work done, as well as to collaborate on bringing resource together to get hazard reduction burning done in every available opportunity this year, we're very pleased that we're able to achieve a 21% improvement on the amount of hazard reduction done last year.
Emergency Services Minister Jihad Dib says that 20% more hazard reduction has been done this year compared to last year.
Now, we've been going pretty full on. We've been going hard, and we will continue with that. This is now a four-month time frame since Task Force FireGuard has started. It's a chance to reflect on that. It's a chance to look at lessons learned through that particular lens and then look at what we can do in the upcoming 2 months. It's been no secret either, and certainly everybody will see what's happening in the Northern Hemisphere, that we face some elevated risks this summer. We know that it's going to be a warmer than average summer. We know also that it's going to be a below than average rainfall period. We can't control the weather, but what we can do is ensure that we're as best prepared as possible, and that means undertaking hazard reduction work whenever that window opportunity presents itself.
And Agriculture Minister Tara Moriarty says farmers have a role to play not only in preparation for bushfire season, but in many cases on the front line fighting fires in rural areas.
We do. So farmers are involved and have supplies on their farms, or should have, and we're encouraging farmers to be ready for the upcoming season as part of the work that we're doing today and every day in New South Wales. If you're in particularly an isolated property, you've got to have a plan. You've got to be ready to go for if the worst does happen, and you've got to be able to have talk to your family and, if it's a big property, your workforce about how to deal with the threat of a fire if it is to arrive, how to escape, what your plan will be to get out of the region that you're in, particularly if there's limited road access. So part of the coordination work that we're doing is about engaging with farmers and landholders in every corner of the state to make sure that they have plans in place, they have materials on their properties that will assist with fighting fires, but importantly that they and their families and their businesses have plans for getting out in the right circumstances if that's what's required. The hazard reduction work that occurs through RFS and the work that we're talking about today that will be coordinated across agencies is essential, but we need every member of the community to be a part of that as well. And we need every household to have plans in place and preparation in place and to have thought about the risk of fire, particularly if they are in remote and regional parts of New South Wales. You've got to have a plan.
That's Agriculture Minister Tara Moriarty there talking about some of the issues discussed at that roundtable discussion on bushfire preparation. It's taking place today. It's aimed at coordinating resources between firefighters, New South Wales National Parks and regional communities and farmers as well. And getting some texts on the issue of varroa mite. Steve says varroa mite hate cloves. Perhaps we could look into that as some sort of natural remedy for varroa. I know some of the organic remedies as well. I don't know whether cloves are involved in that or not, Steve, but there certainly are a few other options out there. And Greg from Cooma is reminding me, I think I might have inadvertently said cereal crops. So I was referring really to canola crops, but he says they're, of course, cereal crops are self-pollinating. But, yeah, varroa mite and the bees there, the real concern is pollination of almond, canola, also fruit crops like apple crops and things like that as well. Obviously need pollination. So that's a concern that's been raised by New South Wales Apiarists Association. They say they need some more help from the government to make sure their bees are healthy enough to do the pollination that's necessary to for our food security. It's coming up to 10 minutes to one.
You're listening to The Country Hour
on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Hello, I'm Andy Park. Join me for The World Today. One New South Wales town dependent on tourism is battening down the hatches ahead of the arrival of bird flu. In Europe, drought has forced the closure of water-dependent nuclear power plants in Romania. There are reports of US Navy personnel jumping overboard amid food shortages and poor conditions aboard US aircraft carriers. And 5 years on from the withdrawal of Afghanistan, what lessons have been learnt? And what ones have not? Those stories and more. Join me for The World Today.
But here on The Country Hour, after 6 months of hard work and dedication, agriculture students from all over the state came to Dubbo this week to battle it out in the New South Wales Merino Weather Challenge. St Matthew's Catholic School in Mudgee took out the top prize, winning the Grand Champion Pen of Weathers. It came after they also won both the highest wool and carcass value in their zone as well. Teacher Judy Raw and her students were ecstatic about the win.
Ecstatic about our win. There was a lot of beautiful sheep here today. So I knew we had lovely fleeces, but sometimes you don't really know until that wool comes off, you know, what the carcass is going to be like. I know you can feel and everything, but yeah, we were pleasantly surprised when we got scanned yesterday and our eye muscle and our fat depth were, quite good actually. So to actually have the carcass as well as the wool, which was fantastic. But there were some lovely animals here today and, you know, with the wet weather, there was a few wet ones. Luckily ours kept dry, but yeah, no, fantastic, because we won this 2 years ago. So, yeah, the kids have got a great grin on their face. So, yeah, I think our agricultural numbers at our school is going to be going through the roof now, because they'll all want to come over to the show.
Particularly after your recent Dooney win as well. Like, it's just been such a big month. The looks on their faces, the excitement. What did that mean after all their hard work and the results?
Oh, great. You know, winners are grinners, as they say. And, you know, what kids are like. They all like, you know, to get a ribbon and just to get a blue one, but to get that, you know, that red, white and blue one. So, yeah, so they will be very noisy on the bus going home, back to school. Yeah, no, and they're a great bunch of kids. They've never done this before, so they're all a little bit apprehensive and nervous. So it was really great to see them, that they'll, you know, you'll be able to go back to school and spruik about their win and,
What's next for you guys for the ag program?
Yes, well, at the moment we've got cattle. We're preparing for a hoof and hook competition for Scone, so there'll be another show coming up in October, so there'll be a lot of students on this team that'll be wishing to try out for the hoof and hook comp at Scone for the Beef Bonanza in October.
The win, how are you feeling?
Yeah, really awesome. It was such a good experience to come out here and experience it all.
Yeah, pretty ecstatic to take out the Grand Champion. We've learned a lot. There's a few ups and down stages, but we managed to get the win in the end, which was quite a good feeling.
How confident were you, after those other two wins? Or did you still get that element of surprise when they, you know, read out your name?
Yeah, it was definitely a big surprise when they read it out. We weren't expecting that, but yeah, it was always good to come home with the win.
When they called second and third, we started to get real nervous, and then they called us, which was pretty great.
How enthusiastic does that make you feel about, you know, agriculture going forward and into your futures?
Oh, pretty amazing. And our teachers at school have been helping us throughout our whole year so far. They've helped us come and win the Grand Champion. On the mat, we won both of our categories. With the carcass, overall, we won in our zone. Yesterday in the wool, we also took out first on the mat, which was pretty good.
So do you think you were in with a chance?
Yeah. We saw them pretty solid. We saw them nice and consistent. Similar to other schools, there was a lot of great competition throughout other schools for us. So they stood up to the test and put on a good show and everything. We're a bit nervous coming into it, but the nerves sort of disappear after a while.
When you start winning, it might help. Yeah. What have you found with the lead-up and with such a mixed season?
It's been rough with the wet weather and the growth of a lot of weed, so the vegetable matter and the wool. So that's been a very big struggle, but it's good that there's a heap of grass around for available feed for the sheep, so we can keep them out in the paddock and let them be a bit free.
How much preparation with the handling side of things? How did you go with that?
Yeah, there was a fair bit of preparation. Everyone contributed to doing it, so halter training. That took a couple of weeks just to try and get the silly out of them, holding on to them and everything and jumping. Then we had to every fortnight or week, every sort of week, we had to weigh them, make sure their weights were still going up, make sure they were still filling out and making sure they look good, checking their wool, making sure there was no burrs in their wool, checking their teeth, so mouthing them, check their age, make sure they're not cutting teeth, make sure there's still weathers in the show and everything. Feeding was a big part of it.
Are you guys off farms? Where have you found your passion?
I've always grown up around sheep and cattle and cropping and stuff, so I've grew a very big passion about that kind of stuff. So I always knew from a young age I wanted to pursue it in school and probably out of school too.
Yeah, I grew up in the city and moved to Mudgee about 5 years ago. We ended up living on a property with our family. I just came to school and I saw what everyone was doing and I was just really wanted to get in there and have a crack. With the school offering such a great program, it's been great to learn more and have this great opportunity.
Well, I used to live in the city as well, and then I moved down to Mudgee 9 years ago, where we moved onto a farm and then we worked with cattle and sheep, which I got my passion for that.
Growing up on a farm when I lived in Gloucester, we had sheep and cattle up there, so going to cattle yards and everything. Then we moved to Mudgee probably 7 or 8 years ago. We live on a property still, got a couple of sheep and everything. And then my older brother's a stock and station agent, so he's helped influence my passion for agriculture.
I've lived on a farm my whole life, lived in Tasmania for most of it. We grew up with a lot more grass than here, so we had a lot of cattle and a lot of farm.
Oh, it's great to see, you know, even town kids really love agriculture, and we're very lucky at St Matthew's in Mudgee. We've just got a new campus last 4 years, so we've got a lot bigger acreage to run our school farm, and it's just going from strength to strength. And the kids just love getting out of that classroom. They, you know, kids that struggle in those four walls, they get them out in the paddock, and you know, and you see a different side of them, and it's just wonderful, especially in this merino weather competition. Just, you know, merinos are such a wonderful animal, you know, the wool that they produce, and then, you know, the carcass as well. So yeah, so ag, we really want to promote ag in our area and at our school.
That was St Matthew's High School ag teacher Judy Raw and her student speaking with Lucy Thackray after taking out top honours at the New South Wales Merino Weather Challenge in Dubbo. You're listening to The Country Hour. It's nearly coming up to three minutes to one. Well, staying with winners, though, because Riverina Rice Guys Chris and Kate Mooreshead have been named the 2026 Sunrise Growers of the Year for innovation and leadership in the industry. The third-generation growers at Amberley Pastoral Company near Yenda, alongside Chris's parents Harry and Anne, they're part of a diversified 1,200-hectare irrigated farming operation. The judges highlighted the Mooreshead's pioneering work in aerobic rice, with the business transitioning its entire rice program to the water-efficient production system this season. So congratulations to them, the 2026 Sunrise Growers of the Year, Chris and Kate Mooreshead. Let's go to markets. First up to Griffith Sheep and Lambs.
Good afternoon. More numbers came in for a stronger market, with most buyers showing a bit more interest today. 7,800 lambs, including about 600 new season. The tops of these sucker lambs were very good at about 26 to 28 kilos carcass weight and made from $296 to $340 to be in the high 11s to $12 a kilo. There were still some supersized lambs off grain coming through in the old lamb run, six pens over 400 to a top of $440, with the more normal size export lambs from $340 to $394. Carcass prices started at about $10 on the extra heavy and up to $11 a kilo on the other weights. The trade to heavy lambs met solid demand at $280 to $330 for the lead. A lot of trade Dorper lambs from $260 to $300. Estimated rate for a lot of these lambs, $11.20 to $11.80 a kilo. Better finished merino lambs, $260 to $322. Sheep sale also had more go in it again. Big crossbred and Dorper ewes, and also merino ewes in wool out to $300 again. After this, a lot of sheep, $210 to $270. The better lines of mutton, $8 to about $8.60 a kilo. Jenny Kelly for MLA.
To Tamworth Cattle.
A reduced yarding of 1,896 cattle were scanned in Tamworth this week for the fortnightly store cattle sale. It was a fair quality yarding, with most cattle presenting in store condition and showing the effects of winter. A solid field of buyers were in attendance, with local competition making up the majority. Angus steers under 200 kilograms were dearer to make from $930 to $1,020 a head. Crossbred steers made from $680 to $1,030 a head. Angus steers 200 to 280 kilograms made up the majority of the steers. They were also stronger to make from $1,040 to $1,640 a head, an average $5.83 a kilogram. Crossbred steers the same weight made from $790 to $1,560, an average $5.55 a kilogram. The best of the yearling steers made to $2,000 or $5.40 a kilogram. No heifers have been offered as yet. For a full market report, please see MLA.com later this afternoon. This is Hamish Hosegood in Tamworth for MLA.
You've been listening to the New South Wales Country Hour. That's it for us for the week. We'll talk to you on Monday. Have a fabulous weekend. We'll talk to you then.